Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the intersection between food, agriculture, and competition. Learn how a chicken raising contest in the 1940s led to the poultry industry we have today.
And they were going to run a contest and try and develop what they would call the chicken of tomorrow.
We'll also venture into the world of agricultural video games, where a new set of tractors is making a lot of fans happy.
The biggest addition to 19 was the John Deere's. That's what everyone was hyped for.
And we pay a visit to a group of Indian restaurants that aren't on the friendliest of terms.
Usually they wait for my restaurant, but after long wait, they go to next door or downstairs. But this is how they do business. They completely copy whatever we do.
Embrace your competitive spirit and be the first to listen to new Meat and Three episodes by subscribing now. That's Meat plus sign THREE, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie. Mark Padungpat has written on Thai American foodways, Asian American suburbia, and is currently researching the history of Asian restaurant health inspections in the United States. We'll be chatting about the history of Asian migration to the suburbia, impact of wholly Asian-dominated public spaces, and whether these spaces ease or hinder assimilation. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Hey, thanks for having me, Coral.
So we're going to start really big. What is Asia and how has people who identify as Asian changed over time?
Yeah, so Asia, I think most people think about Asia as a geographic region, right? A physical place. And that geographic region encompasses Asia and the Pacific, you know, over 40-something countries, and it's a real place with real people. And the important thing that tends to get forgotten is that these people are incredibly diverse, both in terms of cultures and histories, cultural production, topography, and extremely heterogeneous in terms of class and ethnic background, economies and political systems. So it's an incredibly diverse geographic region, but it's also an idea. And I'm not the first to say this. A number of scholars have said this, you know, for the past 20, 30 years, right? It's actually the past 40 years since Edward Said's Orientalism. So it's an idea, and it's been considered an idea since, you know, ancient Greece. And it exists in the imagination, in the Western imagination, as foreign, mystical, exotic place, and this is what Said was getting at with Orientalism, but also like irrational, savage, feminine, everything that the West was not, childlike, it was uncivilized. And I think today it's seen still, I would argue, in those terms, but also very much in terms of a fascination. It's a source of inspiration for a lot of people in the quote-unquote West. It's philosophical. In some ways, it could be a serum to Western culture and degeneracy. And so it's a geographic region. It's an idea. And we also can't forget that because it's an idea, it is also then a political relationship to the West, right? It's seen as inferior. It's seen as unequal to the West. And it's been defined by colonialism and imperialism, war and militarism. So I think when we think about Asia and the Pacific, it's all of those things.
Mm-hmm. So let's continue with the historical context. Can you talk a bit about the migration of Asians to the suburbs post-World War II and why the suburbs, why bypass urban environments entirely?
Yeah, so the history of Asian Americans in suburbia in the United States after World War II, it has to start with the basic foundational background, and that is that suburbia was predominantly white spaces by design. So they were racially exclusive from the get-go. And so for Asian Americans, this entering into the suburbs after World War II was not just a natural phenomenon, but it also reflected changes to suburban policies. It reflected global geopolitics, specifically the United States' relationship with Asia and the Pacific, and the United States needing allies in order to expand capitalism abroad, established more relationships with Asian and Pacific countries, but also portrayed them more positively. And that had an impact on Asian Americans at home. And so those factors, coupled with the 1965 Immigration Act, so a large number of Asian Americans coming to the United States, the Civil Rights Movement, Fair Housing Act, all of those things worked in concert to make it possible for Asian Americans to enter into suburbia. And I think the move from the move directly to the suburbs and bypassing urban areas has a lot to do with the class dynamics of Asian America after 1965. You get this large class bifurcation of Asian America itself. Class, ethnic backgrounds becomes wildly heterogeneous and wildly diverse. And so those Asian Americans who could afford to bypass, urban areas, urban cores, and this is what Wei Li talks about in Ethnoburbs, and a number of other folks as well, is that they are able to purchase homes in suburbia and, build lives there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should back up a bit. By our conversation, it kind of sounds like it's been very easy for Asians to migrate to the suburbs. So can you talk a bit about how initially it wasn't so easy and it wasn't so Asian dominated? My parents are in Irvine now, and they were talking about how when they first moved, they were the first, or it was really rare that they would run into another Asian. And now it's like completely, it would be rare to run into someone that's not Asian.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, it's, they're very much like, other folks of color who try to move into the suburbs. One of the main mechanisms that was implemented in suburban residential neighborhoods to keep people of color out were racially restrictive covenants, which were deeds or private statements in deeds that said you cannot sell to quote-unquote Orientals, to Negroes, to basically any non-white person. And so Asian Americans, were excluded from suburbia a lot in those ways. But then also after World War II, there were still, beliefs among many white property owners, and Charlotte Brooks writes about this in her book, Scott Kurashige's The Shifting Ground of Race. He discusses this and explores this as well. But it was incredibly difficult for Asian Americans to move in because they were still seen as foreigners. Even though they were friends abroad, within the United States, they were seen as still very much unassimilable. And so it was difficult for them to move in. And they had to fight to move in. And we forget that history sometimes, that it wasn't just a natural thing that all of a sudden they had the money and they were able to move in, but they had to fight. They had to take it to the Supreme Court. They had to, I think one of the first families or among the first families in Los Angeles was a Asian American family who had to move in the middle of the night because they purchased their home, which was under a restrictive covenant. And if anybody found out that they were going to move in, they could have their home taken away from them just like that. And so they had to move in the middle of the night. So all kinds of things, all kinds of tactics and strategies that Asian American used. And you're absolutely right. It wasn't easy, and it wasn't just a natural thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you write about the right to the suburb, which I believe is the riff on right to the city. And so how would you explain the shift from, Marie Callender's in a strip mall to like a boba place and an Asian bank, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, so that that shift, so I guess I'll start just briefly with, a right to the suburb. And that's something that I'm still thinking through and that I was trying to think through in writing that article. And a right to the suburb is, it is a playoff, Henry Lafar's Right to the City, which is, essentially this idea that cities or idea or concept that we want to develop and produce more inclusive cities and spaces. And that cities right now, because of capitalist production, really value property rights over and property value over use value. So it values capital more than it does how people use that space. And so for me, I was thinking about, you know, can we apply that and borrowing here from Genevieve Carpio and Laura Pulido, Clara Irazabel's article, Right to the Suburb. I was really thinking, like, does this framework apply? And for me, you see Asian Americans really transforming the places and spaces in suburbia. And the question really becomes, is this, are they establishing a right to the suburb? Are they establishing a place for themselves in the suburbs? Are they merely reproducing, you know, the economic makeup or the oppressive structures that suburbia was built on? And so I think that question obviously is still up for debate and up for contestation. And, you know, places like, you know, you think about, you know, you mentioned Marie Callender's and that transformation to like boba shops. And I think Willow Longamum's book, Trespassers, really does a great job of highlighting shopping malls and Asian malls and the kind of stores that we see today in these quote-unquote Asian malls as critical sites of that contestation where Asian Americans are expressing themselves and expressing their cultural backgrounds as Asian Americans, but that flies in the face of how people normally think about suburbia and suburban space.
Mm-hmm. Especially when so many of these malls are dominated by like all Thai or all Chinese signage, et cetera, and that's kind of, I feel like the uninformed opinion of that would be this population is refusing to assimilate or...
Exactly.
Yeah, and so what would then be the more nuanced explanation of that?
Yeah, I think the more nuanced explanation, it might even be a more nuanced approach, is who has a right to these spaces? Mm-hmm. And I think that question it seems very simple, but I think that's a question that we need to focus on. Who belongs and who has a right to these spaces? Is it people who have the money to be able to transform these spaces? And if so, then we're already seeing that with the establishment of these Asian businesses. Is it about the demographics of the area? And if so, we're already seeing that with the way that places like Irvine and Monterey Park, they already reflect, those shops already reflect the demographics of the neighborhood. And I think what we have to move beyond is this idea that there was an old time, a long-standing white community that should have a right to say what these spaces look like when, I think we have to be more expansive about who has a voice in saying what those spaces should look like and who they should serve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then what about the criticism of these places with, let's say, holy signage, Chinese signage being exclusionary?
Yeah. So the idea that that they're specifically for this ethnic group and that no one else is allowed in there?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's from what, you know, scholars like, again, Willow's found, Brian Chung, it's not like, that's not true. It might seem culturally shocking for some people, but it's not exclusionary in the sense that all people are welcome to shop in these places, and a lot of people do shop in these places. So, you know, Ranch 99 or 99 Ranch, whatever you want.
That's a whole nother episode.
Yeah, that whole debate. You know, I call it 99 Ranch. So places like that, just to take it as an example, they're not exclusive to one particular group. They cater to Asian Americans, but everybody is welcome there. And I think Leland Saito has written about this, in his book in the 1990s, one of the first books on Asian American suburbanization that focused on Monterey Park. You know, what he found was that it's not so much exclusionary as it is just, you know, the longstanding white suburbanites, mostly white suburbanites, feeling like they were culturally irrelevant and that they didn't know how to deal with that. And so they weren't being denied access to these places, but they couldn't understand the transformation that was happening. And so they read that as being, you know, as reading, they read that as them being excluded from the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So let's telescope a bit outwards and talk a bit about the idea of model minority. Just if you could give us a refresher on what that is and how that also works to reinforce divisions.
Yeah, so the model minority stereotype or racialization is this idea, well, the modern minority, just as a term, right, is a group, a racial and ethnic minority that has surpassed all other groups in terms of achievement and success, including the dominant group. And it's applied and has been, you know, Asian Americans have been constructed as the model minority who, you know, and those characteristics include, you know, putting your head down, not making waves, and specifically not asking for any public assistance, any government handouts. And the thing that we often miss about the model minority myth is it's not just a stereotype of Asian Americans as proper, smart, nerdy. They work hard. They don't make waves. We miss the key point of it, and the key point of it is that this is used specifically to attack the Black community and Black and Brown people, because everything that's said about Asian Americans as a model minority is really a point about African Americans and Latinos as, you know, as the antithesis of that. And so it's really used to put down other groups and to say that they shouldn't be complaining. And this is why it gets constructed and it gains traction in the 1960s, because African Americans are pushing for structural change. They're pushing for radical transformation. And sociologists and scholars and newspaper and journalists are then highlighting Asian Americans as a group that did not rely on those things. And so it's a direct relationship to other groups. And I think that's important to underline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but despite that, you write about this kind of romantic friendship or relationship between the Latino, Black, and Asian communities, because it's like we're bound or binding against, I don't know, racial oppression. But you also write that it's easy to tell, I'm quoting you, Japanese American from the east or west side of LA, depending on their clothing, whether they wear Latino clothing or like Latino appropriation clothing or Black appropriated clothing. And so how does that not run the risk of being appropriative of the other cultures?
Yeah, I think what we need, I guess my, it's a great question. And, you know, the debate is raging on with no end in sight, cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. I think the first step is, for me, is to distinguish between, is this, when people of color, quote unquote, appropriate from each other, is that different than when white people appropriate from people of color? And so I don't know if I would use the term appropriate. I do think Asian Americans have a privileged status within, in terms of along the racial hierarchy within the United States. And so there is an unequal dynamic there in terms of Asian Americans borrowing from Latinos or African Americans. But I don't know if appropriation is necessarily the term that I would use. Mm-hmm. I think that even though Asian Americans do have a privileged position as modern minorities, I think there's something else going on in terms of shared spaces, shared histories that are very familiar in terms of their history within the United States, even though obviously it's very different and it's unique. But I think there are some similarities between people of color that make appropriation or that label appropriation a little bit misleading to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I ask that because as an Asian American kid growing up in the suburbs with other Asian Americans, a lot of the YouTubers we watched as kids kind of got their claim to fame appropriating, or whatever you're explaining it as. And, you know, I hadn't thought much of it until recently because it just felt like honest and true to our experience. And so I was just wondering what your take would be on that.
Yeah, no, I absolutely know what you're talking about. You know, I think Eddie Wong was charged for appropriating. I'm thinking of Timothy De La Ghetto, who mm-hmm. grew up in Downey, who's a Thai American, has a very kind of Black affect. And again, I don't think I have an answer for that, but I do think the conversation needs to be different, and it should look different than when we talk about white appropriation of people of color. I think that there are shared histories that need to be brought to bear in those conversations, and it's not to say that they're not problematic. I just think that it's different, and like you said, I think it reflects our experiences growing up in some ways, and
So we're gonna take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll get back into the suburbs.
All right.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise and affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Lisa Held, and I'm the host of The Farm Report here on HRN. The Farm Report is a show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Expect from-the-field insights as guests explore how producing fresh, delicious food relates to environmental and community sustainability, justice, and better health. You can find The Farm Report wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. So let's circle back to our conversation about Asian Americans inhabiting the suburbs. And for those who were fortunate enough to buy a house in the suburbs, what is the suburban ideal and how did Asian Americans exert control over this ideal?
Yeah, so suburban ideals. Obviously, I mean, I think the suburban ideals are diverse, and there's not one suburban ideal. But I borrow here, I think, one useful way to think about an Asian American suburban ideal is to think about George Lipschitz's work on the white spatial imaginary and the black spatial imaginary. And the white spatial imaginary that defines suburbia is, you know, property values, property rights, and exchange value of property. That those things define suburban space. It's not that all white people believe that, but that has become associated with suburbia. And the black suburban imaginary is this idea of the suburbs, or the black spatial imaginary, sorry, is this idea of space where its use value is privileged. So it's how we use space. So it's not so much that, you know, this building or this empty building is seen as a way to generate capital, but this empty building could be seen as a way to house people. The priority there is how we end up using the space. And for me, the Asian American suburban imaginary, I'm teaching the class right now on Asian Americans in Las Vegas, and we were trying to figure that out, and we think that it kind of, at this point, it sort of fits in the middle because there are large numbers of Asian Americans who buy into this idea of suburbia being just a place where they can buy property, accrue value on property, and maintain their property value so that they can send their kids to good schools and live kind of private lives. But then there are also other other Asian Americans. Take, for example, Thai immigrants in the 1980s. I wrote about this in my book, where they viewed suburbia as a place where it wasn't the house that was the center of suburban life, but it was the community centers, such as the Thai temple. And so they would, you know, live in the suburbs, but they wouldn't spend all of their time at home or in private spaces. They would be out in public, spending their weekends at the temple, a very public sociability. And so I think that's one way to try to figure out what we mean by Asian American suburban imaginary.
Mm-hmm. And so you also talk about the invisiburb versus the ethnoburb versus the cosmoburb. And could you give key examples of each so it's a bit easier to track?
Yeah, so invisiburb, a term defined by Emily Scobb and Wei Lee. So invisiburbs are suburbs where they're are a large number of, I'll focus specifically on Asian Americans, so a large number of, say, Asian immigrants, but design-wise and in terms of design aesthetic, the way that a home looks, it fits within the existing norm of suburbia. So you wouldn't tell, and hence the term invisible, right? So it's invisible. You can't really tell that there's large numbers of Asian immigrants or Asian Americans living in that neighborhood. Ethnoburb, which, as I mentioned, is a concept developed by geographer Wei Li, is where ethnic expression is very prominent. And so not just homes necessarily, but shopping malls, shopping centers, you know, you look at banks, signage, as you mentioned. So all those things are very, very visible and very, very present. And then Cosmoburb, this is where you think about the high-tech industry, places like Silicon Valley. Brian Chung is writing a great book on this right now where you can tell that it's very much upper middle class, I'm thinking places like Palo Alto, and where the ethnic expression is muted as well, but you do see what you see are more kind of upscale, high-end, if one could argue a kind of like global, cosmopolitan, crazy rich Asians aesthetic.
Yeah, and so given your interest in the intersection between food culture and place and space, I was wondering if we could just run through a few spaces and if you could discuss their impact, role, maybe target audience, and yeah.
Yeah, sure. So just in terms of like neighborhoods or...
Yeah, so I'll give a few examples. So the easiest one, I guess, would be Asian grocery stores, and I think more so in line with your essay on Thai American foodways and what it really means to provide quote-unquote authentic ingredients to the consumer, Thai and not.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, food spaces, the best way to think about food spaces and, you know, thinking about grocery stores, restaurants, these are places that... that make place for Asian Americans. This is how Asian Americans establish a place in both urban and suburban life. And grocery stores are incredibly important because they sustain a community. And I wrote about this with the Bangkok Market in East Hollywood. And so this search for authentic, genuine Southeast Asian ingredients actually then... The grocery store owner, Pramod Tilakamongkun, when he opened the grocery store, all of us, you know, there were very few Thai people in East Hollywood, but after he opens the grocery store in 1972, like within the span of 10 years, you see a Thai community, you see Thai people start to move into that neighborhood. And so the reason that's important is, one, for Thai people, this is where they go to procure food, sometimes to eat food if they sell food at these places, but it's really a way to kind of feel home and to alleviate the sense of disruption and dislocation that happens when you immigrate to a new country. But for the city itself, these grocery stores and these places, they are ways that immigrant communities establish themselves and are part of community development. And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, when we think about who immigrant communities and how do they make an impact on the cities that they live, and if you look at restaurants, if you look at grocery stores, you know, these are people who are not necessarily, they may not be political activists, they may not be involved in, you know, all kinds of like political causes, but they are shaping the city. They're shaping the identity of a city, and they're shaping the physical space of the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so similar, as you mentioned, our restaurants, which I guess get, I hate to use the word, but get more and more authentic with time. So how do those cater to those of that ethnicity as well as those who are not?
Yeah, yeah. So I guess I should also say that when I say authentic, it's in quotes as well. So restaurants, you know, for, you know, obviously they cater to the ethnic population, but they're also these kind of contact zones for people who are not of that particular group. And that's important because it in many ways becomes the primary site. And that's what I argue in my book as well, right, is that when we think about where people are meeting across racial and ethnic lines, that by the late 20th century, they happened quite a bit in food spaces and in restaurants, and we need to take these spaces seriously because this is where ideas get developed about other groups. This is where ideas get reinforced about other groups. And so part of what restaurants then have to do in order to cater to people outside of the group is really fascinating, because then they have to sort of imagine what would be appealing about their group, about, say, Thai people. What would be appealing about Thai people for non-Thai people? And that gets really messy, because then you have to think in terms of, you know, do we make this exotic? Do we change the flavor and the taste of the dishes that we make? And so all of those things are present and factors in restaurants when you are trying to market to those outside of your group.
Mm-hmm. Do you think those same issues are present in food festivals, where it's more about, I guess, distinction and being your most authentic self?
Yeah, I think so. But you start to see, it sort of depends, because in the case of Thai food festivals at the Wat Thai in the 1980s, that was where you could get, quote-unquote, most authentic Thai food, and it was catered specifically to the Thai community. But then when you think about food festivals, there are other kinds of food festivals, and I think we see them more now in the present day, where they're this kind of multicultural collection of of global foods and foods around the world, where I think it might not be as true, or it might not be as I'm trying to avoid the word authentic. It might not be as familiar to those within the group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that so those food festivals, I guess in short, I think food festivals can also, you know, they're not necessarily authentic spaces where you can get where you can get authentic food.
Mm-hmm. And so to build on this yet again, I'm thinking now of Chinatown or like Little Saigons or I don't even know what the little Koreatown, et cetera, et cetera. And so you call them ethnic theme parks. Can you explain why they are?
Yeah, because I think cities have been very adept to marketing these spaces for the benefit of their own cities. And in terms of marking their cities as inclusive spaces, as welcoming spaces, and by default, they're not going to, and I don't think we can expect them to, but they're not going to give a very rich, nuanced history of those communities, because the goal here is to sell the community and to attract tourists. And so I think that alone prevents a more robust, complicated history, which is more useful in terms of thinking about how communities got there and why there are Chinatowns or Koreatowns in the first place. But instead, they're kind of marketed. I would say ethnic theme parks, another term I like, is they're sort of Disney-fied versions of Asian and Asian American cultures that are palatable for tourists and consumers and non-threatening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I then think they are still spaces that are inhabited and used by those who identify with that quote-unquote town. And so it's like it's hard to say the easy answer would just then be to get rid of spaces like this, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly. So I would never, and, you know, I don't think I have said that we need to get rid of these spaces. I think what the question becomes, you know, what role do the inhabitants play in creating these spaces, and what agency and what power do they have in shaping how these spaces look? Can they control the narrative of these spaces, or are they simply relegated to, well, we need to present the community story in this way in order to attract tourists and in order to boom the local economy? Or is there another way that we can present our neighborhoods that are more complicated and more nuanced? And mm-hmm. I think what it comes, it's not so much we need to eliminate them. Like, I wouldn't advocate for eliminating Thai Town, but I think there's ways that Thai Town itself can think about, and they have been, but thinking about how they can portray Thai American history in more nuanced ways.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Boba is the most innocent / unassuming example of this. Like, I feel like it taught me, along with other Americans, what Boba affords in terms of socializing and gathering, etc. But it was presented, like, I wouldn't really consider Boba to be part of my culture, even though it is. Like, I think I was introduced to it along with other American people. So how about you? How about your experience with Boba and understanding of it?
See, this is where my Asian American-ness gets put on trial. I'm not that big of a Boba fan.
Yeah, neither am I. But it's there.
But I think, to your point, but I think it's because I grew up with Thai iced tea.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. so that was my kind of Thai, that was my link to my Thai, my ethnic identity, right? Mm. My Thai American mm-hmm. identity. And then when I saw boba being put in the Thai iced tea, I was like, yeah, that's weird. that's not, it's not really something that I grew up with. And so I think that's partly one of the reasons why I never kind of got into the boba scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at a personal level, it's textural for me. It's mm-hmm. weird to eat and drink something simultaneously.
It's like an all-in-one meal.
Yes.
So for our last few minutes, I'd love to hear about what you're researching currently, the history of health inspections in the United States, which I realize is a huge topic, but if you could give like a brief spark notes into your book and why, what sparked that interest.
Yeah. So I'm working on a project right now, that basically is looking at how cities responded to shifting food cultures. And I'm diving in specifically by looking at, you know, how they regulated Asian restaurants in terms of food handling and whether or not it violated codes and how all of that linked to ideas about immigrantness, disease, foreignness, public health. And so there's been a lot written about Asian and Latino immigrants in relationship to public health. But I thought, well, maybe we could learn something new if we look at it through food and food culture, because I feel like that's where a lot of these ideas got reinforced, and they get reinforced in terms of how Asian Americans or immigrant groups handle their food and then sell it to the public. So I think that was the initial idea. And the really quick example I can give here is in 1982, the state of California passed the Chinese Roast Duck Bill, which allowed, and I was shocked and surprised to discover this, but before 1982, Chinese restaurants couldn't hang Peking duck on their windows, which has become like the ubiquitous image of Chinese restaurants in the United States. But they couldn't do that because in order to get the duck skin crispy, you have to leave it out in room temperature, but that violated health codes. And so Chinese restaurant owners fought and rallied and organized to get the duck exempt from existing health codes. And so that made me think about, well, going back to this idea of, Asia and Asia, what is Asia, what is the Pacific, and it being an idea, do those ideas about Asia and the Pacific as backwards, uncivilized, unclean, does that play out in restaurant health inspections mm-hmm. in terms of how they see when they see Asian Americans cooking food, if it violates health codes, does this become like, oh, this is linked to their culture? So I have all of those kind of questions, and I wanted to do more research on how commonplace that was in terms of, was the Chinese Roast Duck Bill, are there other cases like that we could then explore and examine to try to understand how Asian restaurants and ethnic restaurants, I think more broadly, become really synonymous with dirty dining or dirty food practices.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a perfectly uplifting / bittersweet way to end our episode. Thank you so much for joining me today, Mark.
Yeah, no problem, Coral. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.